The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I am tickled to be joined on the program again by Louise Penny. Hello, Louise.
Hey, Vic. It's been, about a year?
We had you on for your last book. What was that,
yeah.
Glass Houses?
That's right.
Yeah,
yes.
We had you on for that one, and at the time, that was the first time I'd ever interviewed you, and I remarked about how amazing it was that I'd finally gotten you on the program, and here you are again.
I know, poor one. Every time you turn around, my God, it's her again.
You're out on book tour. You're in Manhattan. You have a new novel out. It's called Kingdom of the Blind.
And, yes.
And we probably have at least three or four listeners out there who have never heard of you or the series.
Not possible.
Can you believe that? Do you want to help them out and explain a little bit about what this series is about?
I'd love to. The series, this is book 14, and the series is set in essentially the same place, although it does move around a little bit, with the same core group of characters. It's set in Quebec, just south of Montreal and just north of the Vermont border, in an area called the Eastern Townships. And Quebec is very French, as you probably know. And the main character is the head of homicide. As the series progresses, he becomes the head of the entire police force, and it's called the Sûreté du Québec. And his name is Armand Gamache.
And as we've progressed through the series in this new book, Armand is kind of in the doghouse, isn't he?
He is, because as we discussed last time with the previous book, Glass Houses, he's had to make some decisions that he knew were going to have. There was going to be a blowback. He understood that he couldn't possibly do what he was contemplating doing and there not be a consequence in every way, personally and also professionally. So he now finds himself suspended, pending an investigation, as head of the Sûreté. And what he did was, without giving too much away, was he let a shipment of opioids intentionally through his hands to hit the streets of North America, different cities. But he's managed to get all of them back except a shipment in Montreal. And so it follows. There are a couple of plot lines. Mm-hmm. One has to do with Gamache and some of his decisions in trying to get these opioids back. Because he knows if he doesn't, it could very well kill hundreds of young addicts, perhaps even more, and it would be laid at his feet.
Can we reveal why he let the opioids through? Is that too much?
Well, it has to do with the cartels and having to play this kind of cat and mouse game with the cartels, and he felt that this was one of the tactics he had to use. But he really, really struggled with the decision, and there were many of his colleagues who he greatly admired and respected who were begging him not to take not only this course of action but other things that he felt he had to do. And so that's why also there was why he was suspended, because it was. He ended up, he believes very much in the rule of law, but he ended up having to break the law.
And he cannot really reveal what he's trying to do. And as readers, we can't know that. We have to just go along and try to figure it out as
right.
he gets into this, because his behavior seems normal, yet we know there's something going on, and you have these different storylines, and it's very complicated because of his relationship with his son-in-law. Tell us about this gentleman.
Yes, Jean-Guy Beauvoir is not only his second in command, but as the series has progressed, Beauvoir has ended up marrying Gamache's daughter, and so they have a really a very close relationship. It really is more like father and son. Gamache is very much a mentor for Jean-Guy. It is a loving relationship, and it was important for me to explore because the books are about many things, probably least among them the crime, although they are absolutely and proudly crime fiction. But the crime is really the vehicle to explore a lot of other issues, both horrible issues like opioid and cartels and the violence and the terrible things that happen with addiction and other crime. But really the flip side of that as well, I wanted to explore issues like home, like belonging, like friendship and love. Love in all of its forms, the love of heterosexual love, the love of a man for another man, a woman for another woman, sexually, but also the deep love that people can feel for each other that is not a sexual relationship, like the love that Gamache and Beauvoir share. And so it is, it's a very difficult, a very interesting, a very intimate, a very important relationship in their lives. But because they are both father-in-law and son-in-law, but also colleagues, they can find themselves in difficult, sometimes adversarial situations, as they do slightly in this book.
And as fans of this genre will recognize, the story of a happy marriage involving a police officer is really quite unusual.
I didn't realize that when I first did it. When I first started writing the books, back with Still Life, which came out in 2005, 14 years ago or so, I just created these characters and relationships that I would want to hang around with. And I didn't want to spend perhaps the rest of my life with deeply unhappy, very torn people who are at odds with each other. And the relationship that Armand and Reine-Marie have is very similar to the one that Michael, my husband, and I had. Mm-hmm. So it's a reflection of not an ideal relationship, but one that genuinely exists when two people who love each other and respect each other marry. So yes, it was that's as it turns out, it is unusual.
It's a beautiful thing, and it's a lovely counterpoint when you're reading about bad things, to have some good things to kind of bounce back through the story.
And it's a harbor for them too. Mm-hmm. It's a harbor for these characters that, as you said, it's not they spend their life looking at dead bodies and trying to track down murderers, but they're able to come home to people who love them and care for them and whom they love. Mm-hmm. But there is proof that the books are really inspired by a couple of lines from Auden in his poem for Melville, and the lines are, and it's just two lines. I'm not going to quote the whole thing, but he writes, "Goodness existed. That was the new knowledge. His terror had to blow itself quite out to let him see it." So the books are about terror, but they are really at their heart, they are about goodness. Goodness exists.
And they really are. My guest is Louise Penny. We're talking about her new novel, Kingdom of the Blind. She's out on book tour, and the stop today as we are recording this is in Manhattan, where she just did a Facebook chat last hour, and tonight she's got a book signing and just go, 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 go. And wow, a little bird, actually a duck, confided in me that This book is going to debut at number one on the, am I allowed to say that?
Yes. Oh, yes, you're allowed to shout it from the rooftops even. I'm so excited.
That is wonderful.
And overjoyed.
I remember.
And we just found out that it's going to be number one in Canada as well, which makes it the top fiction book in North America.
Wow. And here you are on our radio show right now. We're just... your last book, Glass Houses, we aired the interview on a Sunday, and I opened up the New York Times, and there it was, debuting at number one. So here we have consecutive number ones on the list. You're in Lee Child territory, Louise.
Well, I think that you and your show are obviously the element that is important. So we need to do it next year and the next every year. You're the magical element.
Thank you, Louise. You're too kind, and I did not wear my waders to the studio.
Yes, you're up to your neck in something.
Okay, as the story begins, I think we can talk about this. Armand receives kind of a strange letter.
Yes, I actually wasn't going to write a book this year because of losing my husband, Michael, and I really just needed to take a year off to regroup and to let that the howl in the head and the heart calm down a bit. It's exhausting, of course, and heart-wrenching. And I needed to figure out life on my own. But I found after about 6 months, so I told the publishers, you know, I just can't. And they were wonderful. They understood. But I found after 6 months, I found myself sitting at the laptop and wanting to write. And one of the things that came to me was I was one of the executors of Michael's will. And in going through the process, one of the people involved said, do you know, anybody can be an executor of the will. And I said, well, okay, but you have to get their permission and they have to sign off on it before any of this happens. And they said, no, you just name them. It could be anyone. It could be the Queen, it could be the Pope, it could be the President, it could be anyone. And I began to think about that. Now, that is an interesting idea. Suppose, and then, you know, you begin to think about it a little bit, and that's what's happened here, is Gamache, Myrna from the village, this young man, neither of them had met, are all named executors of this woman's will, and none of them had ever met this woman. And so that's part of what they're struggling with is how does the woman know that they exist? And why did she choose them for this will? And then the provisions of the will are so bizarre that they initially think that she must have been suffering from dementia. But then as things begin to unfold, Gamache begins to think, well, maybe they're not so bizarre, the provisions. Maybe she wasn't delusional. And that leads on to other issues.
And this woman was known as a somewhat eccentric person. She was a cleaning lady, right? And she was known as the Baroness?
Yeah. She liked to call herself the Baroness and insisted that everybody call her the Baroness, and including her family, her children, and they all just rolled their eyes. And so that sort of lends credence to this issue that she was never actually all that well in the head.
And this young man, this carpenter who no one knows and they can't figure out where he came from, he turns out to be a very important character, but we can't quite figure out how that's going to work. When you start off a story like this, do you know how it's going to work out?
Pretty much, yes. A couple of things I don't really know is that I knew I obviously needed a third person in there, but what his actual character would be, what he would be like, I hadn't really known until he sort of shows up. And then you play with it a little bit. Is he middle-aged? Is he old? Is he young? Is he a he? Is it a woman? And so you sort of think, well, which dynamic will work the best? And what should he be like as a personality? Is he happy? Is he angry? Is he sly? What are some of his qualities? So all of that I sort of allow myself to discover as the book is going on and as the different versions are going on, because I do two or three, four drafts of a book before I feel I can hand it out. So, yes, I knew that there would be obviously a third party and that he would end up being important, of course, otherwise why have him? But what he would be like and how it would be revealed, I often don't really know and just allow that to happen as I'm writing.
Louise, as you line up these drafts, are they significantly different sometimes?
Sometimes. Certainly, if they're going to be different, it'll be from the first to the second. Because the first draft, I've learned, I just need to give myself permission to be almost crazy. Just do whatever. You know, if you want to have an alien invasion, do it. If you want to have vampires, do it. Because it's not going to end up in the second draft. And I'm being ridiculous because, of course, I wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. But there are characters who make it halfway through the first draft who then are never heard from again. Characters who change sex. Characters who become more important. So it's I just throw everything into all sorts of themes, all sorts of poetry, all sorts of plot lines into the first draft. So it. My first drafts are really, you know, you need waiters for them.
How fun.
And then by the end of the first draft, I know what the theme is. I know what who the main characters are going to be. I know how it's resolved. And then I go back and remove all of the extraneous stuff. So from the first to the second draft is often the biggest change.
Okay.
And then the third draft is more fine-tuning, more deepening, can deepen the relationships because the first draft and second draft is really about getting the broad strokes correct. And then there's issues of pacing and structure that, yeah, I have to deal with.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, and it's my pleasure to be talking to Louise Penny about her new novel, Kingdom of the Blind. She's on the phone with us in Manhattan. You've mentioned this first storyline, the one involving the letter and Gamache being one of the executors of this estate, this mysterious estate. Another storyline in this also begins early on, and Gamache is forced to discipline a young female officer in his command, and she's quite a character.
Yes, she shows up for the first time in the series a couple of books earlier, A Great Reckoning, and she's a cadet, but extremely unusual. Gamache, perhaps slightly because of his own background, he really believes in second chances, and he often takes people, officers, or puts cadets into the academy who nobody else sees. Nobody else sees the potential in these people, but he does. And that's very important. It's almost a spiritual act of giving people the benefit. And so he's done that with this young woman, Amelia, who's a former prostitute, just former addiction issues, but clearly really, really smart and a person of great value.
Hmm.
But then she begins to fall apart, and he's struggling. He wants her to do well, and she just can't live up to the potential that he wants her to. And so, yeah, he has to make some pretty difficult decisions.
And Gamache's involvement with her in the story keeps bringing him back to this desolate area in Montreal where all the junkies and the prostitutes and the people who are having a hard time are living, trying to make out a living. And Gamache keeps seeing this child. And there's something very Dickensian about these vignettes where he's down in the city.
Yeah, thank you. That's a lovely way of putting it. It's certainly the underbelly of a great city. And again, it's about the duality, not only of Montreal, which is a great city of culture, of education, huge universities, fantastic restaurants and cuisine and music scene, but you scratch the surface and something else appears, and that's what we see in this book. And as also a counterpoint to the very beautiful Three Pines, which is the village outside of Montreal in the countryside. So it's important to show that both exist, but and also that both have good qualities, and both have their more venial qualities, venal. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was interesting for me to watch Gamache walk through the inner city of Montreal, and have to deal with what he saw, and as you said, catch glimpses of this little girl.
With your books, I often find myself thinking of one word that I would use to describe some of the themes in the book. And for this one, I think the word that I would pick would be redemption.
Mm. Oh, that's nice. That's nice. Yes, certainly what is driving Gamache is trying to redeem himself, and that act that he was forced to do, trying to get the drugs back, but at the same time being in danger of not making it worse, but not making the situation worse in terms of being able to solve the situation, but being forced in order to do it to compromise himself and his soul even more. In order to do it, he talks about at one stage the tyranny of the greater good, and being lashed by that tyranny. So yes, his desire for this young woman, Amelia, to redeem herself. That's a wonderful way to look at this book, and that obviously as well. One of the issues is blindness, about the things that we can't see, our blind spots, our preconceptions, and how we can be very wrong, the delusions that we carry around, blind loyalty, blind faith, all those issues that play a role in this book and can lead people astray when they think they're doing well.
The novel is Kingdom of the Blind. It's the latest from Louise Penny, who joins us on the program today. How do you choose the titles?
Well, this title was interesting for me. It was actually called something else, and they often are, actually. I was about two-thirds of the way through the first draft when one of the characters is confronting someone, and it's a physical. They've got them up against a brick wall, and for some reason, this character, and I had not planned this, kind of snarls into this other person's ear, "I'm the one-eyed man." And that came out of nowhere. And I understood it was an Erasmus quote. In the Kingdom of the Blind, the one-eyed man is king.
Oh.
And I sat back and I thought, oh my God, that's what the book's about. It's about blindness. It's initially the book I thought was about making wrong choices and taking the wrong route, but in fact, it's about what I just discussed. It's about blindness, and that then the whole thing kind of coalesced. And it shocks me sometimes that I can get that far into a book thinking it's about one thing, but then realizing, actually, it's not about that. I've been writing it about something else entirely. And that also helps, obviously, with the second draft, because then I go through it and can clarify and streamline. And once I realize, oh, this is the theme.
Are you going to share the discarded title with our listeners?
Okay. Oh, all right, since it's you.
Okay.
The book opens with Gamache in it's snowing, and he's being called to this house by this with this letter from a notary who he knows is dead, but he shows up because he's curious about what could this possibly be, and it's an clearly abandoned house, and he's sitting in his car looking at it, and the house is all kind of crooked, and it reminds him of. He's got a young grandson. It reminds him, and granddaughters, and it reminds him of that poem, "There Was a Crooked Man." And one of the lines is, he walked a crooked mile, and that was going to be, the title was A Crooked Mile.
Oh.
Mm.
Well, one of the most traumatic scenes in the entire book takes place inside that house, but readers are going to have to discover that on their own.
Thank you for that.
When I read a really beautifully written novel like this one with lots of compelling characters, I'll usually try to choose a character that is very peripheral yet a favorite of mine. And in this book, my favorite peripheral character only appears briefly, and he's this elder brokerage guy who Gamache has lunch with. I love this character. I love what you do with him.
I'm so pleased about that, because he was actually inspired by our financial guy. So, yes, his name is Stephen Horowitz in the book. I won't tell you what his real name is, uh-huh. But I did send him, the real guy, the manuscript, and just sort of, and particularly early on the scenes where he was in, just to see, to make sure that he wasn't going to be too insulted, and he thought it was hilarious. But yeah, I love that relationship, and it turns out in the books that this character who's in his 90s is Gamache's godfather. Uh-huh. Gamache didn't really have a father growing up. He was orphaned by a car accident. And so this man ended up being quite important to Gamache. So they have a lunch together in particular where they discuss it. And but this man, Stephen, is you know, he's not exactly a saint.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm so glad that you liked him.
That's very funny when they're having lunch and then he makes our mom pay.
Yeah, that's right.
That was so well
done. He has all the money in the world. He makes our mom pay.
Yeah.
And not only pay for their lunch, but someone else's lunch in the restaurant.
I think it was worth the cost in that case. I think he was thoroughly entertained. And that does also indicate that there is some financial chicanery going on in this story. And we won't talk about that. But that's definitely one of those clever plot twists that you throw in where we're trying to figure out what the motivations are and what's really happened. And there's definitely some of that going on here.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And that's again, some of the challenge in a book is to make it compelling, whereas you're not really sure, but not confusing. You know, you can't just keep throwing everything out there. It has to, at the end, you go, oh, of course, that's what that was. That's what that was. It's a kind of a fair play thing. So, at the same time, there needs to be, you know, the classic Christie language, red herrings and misdirection.
Mm-hmm.
But again, not so much that it's just, it creates a headache.
Well, Louise, I cannot wait to read the next one, and it's been such a delight to have you back on the program. Thank you so much.
Oh, Vic, I've so enjoyed our conversation and conversations. So next year, same time next year?
Please. I hope you've got another book for next year, and we can talk to you then.
Beautiful. I'd like that.
The book is Kingdom of the Blind. Louise Penny wrote it. You heard about it on the Book Nook. And Louise, I'd like to wish you happy holidays.
And to you and your listeners.
Thank you very much.